Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. The format of the show is a little different today. As you guys know, the mission of Behind the Smile is to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. And one of the ways we do this is by normalizing conversations and sharing people's stories. The other way to do this is through education. Which is why today's episode is with Jo Fishburn, a registered psychiatric nurse who's been working in the field of mental health for over a decade now. Jo is on the front line when it comes to treating people with co-occurring mental health and substance use disorders, which is why I was so keen to have him join me on the show. In this conversation, Jo shares his perspective on the challenges faced by patients and their families, the antiquated nature of the DSM, the impact of trauma on complex personality disorders, and why we're seeing an upsurge in the diagnosis of ADHD. This episode is full of useful information, so grab yourself a pen and paper, unless of course you're driving, and let's kick off this week's episode. Welcome to Behind the Smile with Ash Butters, a podcast designed to reveal the truth behind the masks we wear. Together, we look to demystify the human mind and its behaviours in relation to mental health, trauma, and addiction. My name's Ash, and I'll be your host as we uncover the real stories of people's pain and the steps they've taken to live a life of freedom in recovery. From sobriety to spirituality, join me each week as we uncover the reasons why people seek recovery and how their lives have changed by living one day at a time. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Smile. Today in the studio here with me, I have Jo Fishburn. Jo is a registered and credentialed mental health nurse who's worked within the tertiary hospital system's inpatient units, medical units, community and crisis response teams, and emergency departments as a registered psychiatric nurse. Now, Jo moved into the primary healthcare setting more than 10 years ago, focusing on whole-of-person care for people living with mental illness and addiction issues. Now, I had the pleasure of meeting Jo at a thought leadership event hosted by First Step last year. And the minute I heard Jo talk, I knew that I had to get him here on the show. So without any further delay, I'd love to welcome Jo onto Behind the Smile. Jo, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, Ash. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh my goodness. It's such a pleasure. In the lead up to this interview, we've had a couple of phone calls. And what I love about every time I speak to you is that you can take an idea and extrapolate it beyond measure. I've never known someone to be able to be so passionate to talk on topics that perhaps some people shy away from, and I'm really excited to dive into not only your expertise, but your passion here today. So thank you so much for giving your time and sharing that here with the audience. Now, Jo, so that our audience can get to know you a little bit better, can we kick it off with some nice, easy questions? I want to know where you grew up, what does an average day look like, and what do you do for fun?
So I was born and raised in the Western Plains in New South Wales. I grew up in Canberra and studied in Canberra my undergraduate nursing after a few years in the hotel trade, and then moved to Melbourne and was a general nurse in Melbourne working in burns rehabilitation and neuro rehabilitation. An average day is, weekdays is, I work for First Step, as you know, which is a wonderful place to work. And my weekends are spent running between sporting events or ballet with my two kids.
Sounds lovely. A nice balance between, I'm sure, what you're experiencing day to day at First Step. What do you actually do at First Step?
So First Step as an organisation, we're a specialist primary health outpatient clinic. We do a lot of things. My role there is I'm the manager of the mental health service. So I manage a team. I'm clinically involved as well, but I manage a team of nurses and care coordinators. We manage a program run by the we're commissioned to do by the federal government through the Primary Health Network, which is the part of the STEP care model of mental health care in the primary setting. And it's the Mental Health Integrated Complex Care Program. So it's the top step of the model. The STEP care model was developed when the PHNs were rolled out
What's a PHN?
So sorry, yeah, of course. So it's the Primary Health Networks. Mm-hmm. So prior to that, we saw about 8 years ago, 9 years ago, the country was cut into 31 primary health networks based on the varying demographics and the accessibility to services within those areas. So in Melbourne, we have I work with the Southeast Melbourne Primary Health Network, and that's 11 LGAs across the southeast of Melbourne, whereas, for example, out in Mildura, that will run all the way through. It's quite a large PHN. Mm-hmm. So based, again, on population and certainly varying population needs. And the aim was to then map each of the health network areas. So that was the task of the primary health networks, and to establish the needs within the primary care setting for chronic or ongoing illnesses, from mental health and addiction issues through to diabetes management to any of the chronic continuing illnesses. And from there, they then commission particular organisations to manage, in my case, mental health. And so the step care model starts at the lowest step, which is promotion, prevention, early intervention, e-mental health into accessible psychological services is the next step. And then my step is integrated complex care for people who are living in my community with severe and enduring mental illness. First step itself is 22, 23 years old. Started it quite specifically as to treat opiate dependence through rapid detox and the use of, for example, naltrexone implants, which were of the time quite new, quite cutting edge. Some would say quite cowboy. And we're a not-for-profit charitable organisation. We've grown with the needs of the community, and yeah, over the last at least sort of 10 to 15 years, been more aligned with as best as we can with government services, with needs within the our local government areas, Port Phillip, but within the broader area around Melbourne for people who need treatment for complex addiction issues.
Mm. And often they're co-occurring, aren't they?
And that's the point. Yeah. Mm. So quite early on, we started, and the reason I joined First Step was we were able to employ the then government incentive through Medicare, which was the Mental Health Nurse Incentive Program. All things in health have to have an acronym, so that's MINIP. It could be difficult to say, but if you don't have an acronym, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, it doesn't, yeah.
So, and that provided senior mental health or experienced mental health nurses to work within the Medicare system in the primary setting. And that worked to a certain extent, but it wasn't. It was a fantastic program, and I'm really glad to have been a part of it. But it didn't really direct care to where it was needed. There was no incentive for people to work in any specific area. So there were a lot of mental health nurses working, credentialed mental health nurses, and a credential is given to us by, it's through an application and assessment process through the college, Australian College of Mental Health Nurses. And that allowed us to work in the primary setting and be remunerated through the Medicare system, but there was no incentive. So there were a lot of credentialed mental health nurses working in the inner city. But if you looked at the growth corridors like Whittlesea, for example, there was still significant unmet need in those areas. And that was where I think the health system, the health department federally looked at how do we, not so much incentivize, but how do we direct care? How do we find where the need is and put the right programs in place? And that's where that was the inception of the primary health network system.
Mm. And Joe, what inspired you to get into this kind of work? Because it's quite niche and I imagine quite challenging from day to day.
Yeah, I mean, I think all roles are challenging in some way or another. I was working in the hotel industry in the wine trade. And I thought better of that. And so I went into university with the idea to come out and become an intensive care nurse or a, emergency nurse or something like that, because I really liked the idea of, the body, but, pathophysiology. I really was interested in it. I wasn't the best student. as a school leaver, I left with pretty average marks at best, and I'd been to a lot of different schools. And so I didn't really have much to go on, so I started washing dishes at a Hyatt in Canberra and went from there into the hotel trade. And I enjoyed that. But I went back to university. I did my undergraduate degree in nursing in Canberra, and as I say, with the idea of being the really sharp end, the real all the bells and whistles and the machines that go bing. And came to Melbourne after I registered. I came to Melbourne and started working in neuro rehab and burns rehab, And I was working with a young man who had, through a psychotic episode, had injured himself quite significantly by self-immolation, by setting himself on fire.
Wow.
And an amazing, beautiful young man who, he came to our ward about 6 months after that from the acute burns unit across to us. And so I just worked with him each day. So there was lots of the technical side of things, the dressings that we do, and he was a one-to-one patient because of the extent to the dressings that were needed. But he was just a really awesome guy, and we did a lot of talking, and I learned a lot more about psychosis, and I learned a lot more from him about mental health. And I realized that I got really sick of doing the scrubbing and the dressings and the technical stuff. I just wanted to talk to him. So after he was discharged, I went the following year. He was discharged just prior to Christmas of that year, and I went the following year back and did my graduate diploma in mental health or psychiatric nursing, and started in psych. And it was good because it was still, you still need to know the general health of a person, but there's less of the machines and the technical side. It's more to do with the person, getting to know the person and their needs, and developing relationships and finding out where you can help sort of walk with that person so their lives improve day to day.
And so a patient or a client who arrives at First Step, at what stage of the journey they come into contact with you?
Any number of ways. Usually if they're referred by the primary health network, so the process it's clunky in a way, because even if they were a client of one of the GPs at First Step, the process is that the referral goes to the primary health network, and the primary health network refers that person back to me.
Oh, that's interesting. So it goes out of the organisation and then back in again.
That's right. With the SEMFN, the Southeast Melbourne PHN, they're a really good team. They're flexible and reactive to what's going on, how the programs are actually running on the ground. We, as a MIC provider, mental health integrated care provider, are the only provider of that program that has GPs co-located. And so it would be different for others who are not working in a GP clinic. The GPs would refer, and that then the referral would be accepted into that program. So it's sort of clunky only for us.
Yes. And so for those who may not be following along, what we're talking about here is when you arrive at First Step, it's a one-stop shop essentially for everything that you need if you were experiencing any sort of mental health illness or addiction problems. You go there and everything you need, from legal support to GPs to counselling, like, it's all there under the one roof. And you guys all communicate with each other, right?
Yes, yeah, that's right. So we're a small team, and so the intake process, certainly you come to First Step, as you say, you come to the reception and or you call in and arrange an appointment. Often it's with the GP, but it doesn't need to be. Sometimes it is to ring through looking for legal support. Our legal team has developed. It's a separate entity as such, but it's still First Step Legal. So it's what we refer to as a health justice partnership. So we can receive referrals from the legal service. The aim of the legal service is, as a health justice partnership, it's to work with people who are addressing or engaging with services to help them with the issues that have either arisen from their interaction with the justice system or as a result of or prior to.
I imagine that's quite a high proportion of people that walk through the doors. You know, if they've been battling addiction for a number of years, unfortunately, the sad situation and the reality of it is that they have probably had to do things that aren't legal to sustain their habits, and therefore they end up having to answer to the justice system.
Yeah, absolutely. But also the people really struggling with addiction and with psychological distress, the lives can become quite chaotic, and it can be even, you know, into recovery and established recovery that then the fines come from the sheriff's office to say, hiya, you owe X amount of thousands of dollars in fines. And that's one of the big ones, I think, because, you know, you've worked so hard to get to a point of stability and you're getting back on your feet and you're just making ends meet with a lot of support. And then you get a final notice or a knock at the door. And so that certainly is part of the process that we help with. We have criminal lawyers. We also have a specialist family lawyer who works with people, if that be, or establishing connection with family, with their children, or supporting people to leave the family violence situations, those things as well. So there's the legal profession, and particularly our legal service that we are in partnership with are far more knowledgeable and supportive of situations that arise that are complex. It's not as simple as we deal with this one particular aspect and you can go back to what you do and what you're doing. I think it's a whole of it's incremental whole of life change, and we do that at a time that's suitable as well. So negotiating with the courts has become more easy. The courts are becoming more flexible in a term that was coined, I think, in the United States, a therapeutic adjournment. So giving people time to establish stability and some wellness in order to come back and negotiate with the courts as to what would be best in how they attend to the criminal matters that they have.
And so with that, in layman's terms, is that sort of referring to, say, somebody has to show up to court to answer for these things, and because they've been going to First Step and they've got a team around them and they can prove that they've been, you know, 60 days clean and sober, that all plays in the favour of the decision that the judge may hand down?
Certainly, absolutely. And that to on a case-by-case basis can be negotiated. But the I think it goes back at least 6 or 8 years. The Melbourne Magistrates Court piloted a court. There's a Melbourne court system. There's a Koori court list, for example, for Aboriginal people where the situations are considered in that context. And the ARC list was piloted and has become very successful. And the ARC, again, an acronym, is the Assessment and Referral Court List. And what that to be considered within the ARC list for a number of reasons: intellectual disability, brain injury, significant psychiatric condition, addiction, or you know, that the offending, that the charges can be considered within the context of the person's situation if they have a severe and enduring mental illness or significant addiction and adversity, trauma, complex trauma, brain injury, those sorts of things. And what that allows for is a different approach. So instead of a more formal setting of the court where the charges are heard and a decision is made, the ARC list is a process of judicial monitoring that can last 12 months, where each month you come back before the magistrate and there's a public prosecutor that will inform the court of any further interactions with police within the previous month as a support to our HJP clients, the health justice clients. I go along or I write a report each month to talk about what we've been doing from a treatment perspective and how well that's going, and provide some insight to the court. That, you know, the gold standard obviously would be is the person engaged in formal psychological treatments in some situations, and absolutely that's the gold standard. But the challenge around that is accessibility, but it's also the appropriate timing of that engagement. We're limited to under the Medicare system at 10 sessions a year, and you really want to have those sessions when the person's ready and able to start to work on those skills.
I imagine when the fog is starting to lift, when they're right in the thick of it, how much is actually going in?
That's right. And so to be able to negotiate with the court system to say, you know, if you give us a little while to establish some stability and some, you know, reduction of chaos, improved living conditions, addressing some of the real nuts and bolts stuff, the real material aid stuff that we can do, but doesn't happen overnight. And then we'll come back and see you in a month's time, and then a month after that, a month after that. The other thing about the ARC list that I think is fantastic is that it's not formal. You sit at a table with the magistrate, with the representatives from the assessors within the ARC, Assessment and Referral Court. The assessors are there, and that's sort of my link to the court, rather than if this is done through a corrections order, the decisions are already made and the requirements are placed on the person. So in a way, it allows the person time to an agency to be able to achieve the things that are otherwise just simply required of them as a result of the conviction and the corrections order.
And I think it's important to understand that people that are dealing with complex mental health issues or some form of addiction, it's one thing to get clean and sober, or it's one thing to start engaging in the services, but it can take time. And I think for anybody that hasn't been affected by, let's just say, addiction, for instance, I think there can be an assumption, you know, well, they're not drinking anymore, so why are they still not okay?
Yeah, whereas absolutely.
It's such a long journey to recovery, isn't it?
It is, and for so many people, they didn't choose that as a kid. They didn't aspire to that situation, and trauma plays a significant role in your own development, and you know, you don't escape childhood unscathed in so many ways. And so addressing that trauma is going to take time, and it takes stability, and it takes engagement and trust, support.
Trust is a big one, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Let's go there. I was going to ask you about this a little bit later, but you've touched on trauma, and something that you were sharing when we met that first time was the stigma associated around particular mental illnesses or mental disorders, bipolar, BPD, you know, those sorts of within that realm, and the misunderstanding around the trauma that occurs, which then leads to this presentation. Can you talk more about that?
So I say again, this is the musings of an old mental health nurse, rather than that it's academically underpinned. The way that the DSM or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry is developed, it's cut into axes. So axis one is psychiatric conditions, and that, for example, affective conditions, which is depression or mania or a bipolar. Psychotic illnesses such as schizophrenia, PTSD sits there as an identified and treatable psychiatric condition, anxiety disorders.
Are they all in the one bucket?
They sit in the axis one.
Okay.
Axis two conditions are, again, quite an array. So, for example, pervasive developmental disorders such as autism spectrum disorder sits in axis two because it's pervasive. It's certainly there are interventions that can be made, but it's not considered a treatable psychiatric condition in the same way as a depression or a generalized anxiety disorder.
But you can't take a pill and that'll alleviate the symptoms of autism.
Simplified explanation. Yeah. And again, what were considered pervasive is personality disorders. There's a series of those, and that probably the most common and the most common to come into contact with mental health services are people that's described as a borderline personality disorder or an antisocial personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder.
And I didn't realize that was
so. They're in clusters, and there are formulas for that for diagnosing these conditions. Considered pervasive, and certainly not disregarded in the psychiatric system, but are considered in a different way. And yet, at the same time, we know that the developmental period of a person's life, so from birth through to early teen and one to seven, one to eight, or up to early teens, that these personality structures and damages or disorders are developed in that time. That's where our personality is developed. And that's you know, our way of negotiating with the world and interacting with the world. But what we do know is that a very significant proportion of people who are identified as having a borderline personality disorder have a history of significant trauma in that developmental period. And we also then, jumping back to axis one, have a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, which we most commonly we would attribute to first responders or to returned service men and women. What we're seeing more now and developing a better understanding of, what, rather than a post-traumatic stress disorder associated with a series of events that are known and identified, and you know, for example, years ago we called shell shock, for example, coming out of World War One. Is what now is referred to as complex PTSD, and complex PTSD will present in a different way because the triggers are varied. The triggers are often not easily identified, and so therefore the responses and the exacerbations of PTSD of that person's trauma are very, very varied, and can actually look very similar to what we've described as borderline personality disorder, which is a difficulty in establishing, maintaining relationships, a very concrete black and white thinking. Adoration and disdain is often associated with the breakdown of relationships. So the person is adored until they're not. And you look at the crux of it, you can understand why, if a person has a very unpredictable and fluctuating childhood and care provision as they grow, their ability to slowly increase their negotiation and understanding and independence in the world is marred by the fact that they don't know what's going to happen, because yesterday it was okay to do this, today it's not. Mm-hmm. Yesterday I knew where I was staying, today I don't. Yesterday it was traumatic, today it's not. So it's really challenging as you're growing up to get a strength and a sense of agency in the world if have a very unpredictable and fluctuating and changing care provision and support.
So this could be a child that, you know, perhaps grows up in an alcoholic home, or, I mean, I'm wondering, could it be even more subtle than that, Joe? Could it be growing up in an environment where maybe you didn't know when your dad was coming home? You know, sometimes he was there, sometimes he wasn't. Or, like you said, you don't know what version of the parent you're going to get on any given day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's also, I mean, there's a lot of work in establishing and has established some genetic predisposition or vulnerability. There's also the physiological makeup of the person's brain. It can vary, and on functional MRIs, they're identifying areas of the brain that are overactive or underactive in particular presentations of personality disorders. There is certainly a school of thought around a clear genetic basis or the narcissistic personality disorder that can be described as a clear genetic structure that predisposes the person. But I think that my feeling, certainly not being in that academic field, my feeling is that the environment can't be disregarded, and the environment's quite significant. There are probably thousands of very, very functional sociopaths in the world. They aren't all Dexter, you know. So I think, you know, environment has a significant role to play. And growing up, you look back at your own childhood, and anyone can look back at their own childhood and say parts of it were blessed and parts of it weren't. And I think it's the predictability that allows, you know, babies' vision grows day on day. So, you know, you've really got to stick your face in at a baby, and they primarily the first few weeks they're basing that on smell more than vision. And as the vision improves and increases, so does their interest in heading out and investigating the world. And if somebody's there stably, consistently supporting that investigation, then that will certainly provide agency and sort of faith in the world as you go. And if some days you don't know if mum's coming home or dad's coming home, you don't know if you're going to have something to eat, and you're not sure if you're going to be able to get to school the next day, those sorts of things, that's really hard to then get sense of self, a sense of agency and a sense of faith in the world that you've got some sort of support behind.
I love what you've just touched on there. I think it's so important to highlight, because the reality of life today and the environments is that over 50% of marriages end in divorce, and therefore at least 50% of homes are broken. So for anybody who is a single parent right now listening, thinking, well, what the hell am I meant to do? Like, it's just me. I think you've just answered that question. It's not, you, like, maybe you can't avoid not having two primary caregivers or a mum and a dad, you know, the nuclear family, but as long as there's stability there and the child has permission to explore and to grow, then
I think that certainly that certainly is a significant benefit in the development of kids. We also live in a world, and I think I'm quite grateful for that, we don't have the very old-fashioned standard nuclear family. Yeah. You know, I have friends who are same-sex attracted in long-term relationships raising kids, and so that's different. There are people who choose to have children as a single parent from the outset.
Yeah.
And as you say, 50% of marriages or long-term partnerships end in separation or divorce. I think that the way in which that's done, and the, again, providing knowledge, understanding, predictability and safety in that process is as much as, rather than, for example, consistently living in an unhappy environment too. So, I mean, we can't, I certainly don't want to seem as though that's the be all and end all, but I think that, you know, we all develop an understanding of the world as we grow up, and I think that the more support and stability we can have is going to fare us well.
Can we talk about, just staying on this topic of the DSM for a moment, the difference between, well, a lot of people are talking about neurodiversity at the moment. More people than ever that I know are being diagnosed with ADHD. Can we unpack this a little bit? Because I'm still quite new to understanding the different facets of this. For instance, starting with, what's the difference between neurodiverse versus schizophrenic? Where does that sit on the DSM?
Oh, okay. So, well, neurodiversity is a term that broadly describes pervasive developmental disorders, I suppose.
Like the ones we were just talking about.
Yeah, so autism spectrum disorder, for example, is that spectrum's getting bigger and bigger. And I think, I'll speak to it, but it's certainly not my area of expertise. But I think that the more we understand about it, the more we realise we don't understand, which is positive, I think, in so many ways. ADHD was, traditionally ADHD was described as almost invariably in male children, when females were identified as having ADHD, it was initially, I suppose, described in many respects as atypical because the hyperactivity wasn't there, the standard classic presentation of that baby wasn't there. But in actual fact, I think ADHD is now better understood through a lot of different realms that, you know, we try to categorise for a lot of reasons. The cynic in me says that we categorise in health in order to monetize it. So, you know, if you've got, and we do, we've got the World Health Organization has the International Classification of Disease. It's up to the 10th revision and that gives you codes when you those codes and those codes will therefore have a remuneration figure associated with them. The DSM.
When you prescribe or just by taking a consult that falls under that code?
These are codings for example, in hospitals. So you go into hospital for a, and again, this is not my area of expertise, but if you go into hospital for a particular a procedure, operation, length of stay associated with that is a myriad of different codes.
Okay.
And each of those codes come is about the recompense from the previous year. So a hospital has a series of episodes of care and there is literally thousands of codes associated with that, and those codes lead to remuneration from the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to a certain extent we like to classify, or we aim to classify, presentations of disease in order to help us understand them and treat them, but also because it helps you can then replicate that okay, well, here is a cluster of symptoms and what does that usually mean and so you can refine that into a diagnostic title. Psychiatry is a little different, I think, in that you can't always look for pathology or imaging to see, okay, well, there's the issue, there's a deficit in or an increase in this particular blood test, but are we dealing with a more pervasive illness here?
So I remember, I have to jump in for a moment, when I was really young and my mum used to tell me that if I smoked weed I could turn schizophrenic. And I think obviously that was a very like a fear tactic to prevent me from dabbling in weed. But what is there any truth in that? Like, does schizophrenia lie dormant and then something activates it?
Okay, that was a big one, wasn't it? Yeah, it was similar in my childhood too. It's been found, so no, not really. Schizophrenia is a pervasive psychotic illness or set of illnesses, and the thinking is that using weed, using cannabis can certainly, as you say, it's not so much that it would lie dormant forever, but the feeling is that statistically it would suggest that it has an earlier onset for people who were predisposed if they use cannabis. The other thing about cannabis is for certain people in this space that we're talking about, it can increase the risk of residual positive symptoms, so symptoms that don't respond to treatment. Whereas in other psychiatric conditions, it's being identified as being quite a positive, you know, they're synthesizing and isolating particular parts of cannabis to in order to treat psychiatric illnesses. It's CBD is being used to reduce seizures in children that don't automatically respond to normal anti-seizure. So there's, you know, yes, that was, it wasn't so much an old wives' tale, but it was certainly, it certainly has some merit in so far as it can be damaging for certain people who have a chronic psychotic condition. It can see an earlier onset and actually make the condition more difficult to treat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's go back to the ADHD topic for a moment, because I interrupted you there. Why do you think there is such a prevalence of diagnoses around ADHD today? I mean, it seems like it's just exploded.
Yeah, it's controversial and has been since the start. I was raised by two teachers, one a primary school teacher, and my father was a university lecturer. And my mother could clearly see this was a cluster of symptoms that should be considered for more investigation and potential treatment. But my father was old school, and it's just a bad excuse for poor behaviour. And I think that still certainly that remains. Some of that thinking still remains. I don't think there's one clear reason why we're seeing more and more diagnoses. You know, the explosion of treatment for ADHD is interesting, because I think it's important to note that it doesn't automate. It's not like a bacterial infection that will require antibiotics or where it will remain. It's a cluster of symptoms that can be housed within that diagnosis. But at the same time, there are a whole lot of it's a whole lot of work being done to help manage and learn to live with form of neurodiversity without medications. Medications in and of themselves can be helpful for some, but not for all. If you're talking about a psychostimulant, so you've got the cardiovascular risks associated and those sorts of things.
Yeah, and like, so for me, I want to share this because I'd love to know your thoughts around prescribing these medications to people who are in addiction recovery. My ex-husband was prescribed Ritalin, and when I was in active addiction, I used to crush up his Ritalin and snort it to clean the house. Now, obviously, I know I wasn't prescribed to me, but I've also had friends in recovery who are prescribed these drugs, and the doctor is saying, well, if you're experiencing the symptoms, just take more. And that to me is crazy for somebody who might have had an addiction to anything that made them, you know, any sort of amphetamine-based drug.
You'll see a larger number of people with an unidentified and untreated ADHD presenting to addiction services because for some they look for other ways to manage what they don't quite get, why their brain doesn't work like other people. I've seen some great successes in people who were, for example, dependent on benzodiazepine to manage significant social anxiety that were able to very relatively quickly rid themselves of that once they started a treatment for ADHD. Now, this you're talking about treating with a psychostimulant, so it's not they're two different.
They do different things.
They work on different neurotransmission. So you certainly will see people manage their distress in certain ways, and when they come to realise, okay, well this is detrimental. Methamphetamine it does cause damage to the brain, whereas psychostimulants like Ritalin and dexamphetamine, they enhance the activity rather than actually cause permanent damage to the brain, to the receptors. We also, the assumption that, well, you know, but you smoke heaps of weed, that would mean you don't have ADHD. Again, that's certainly not the case. It's you have to think about it in a broader context. Can see any sort of use of different medications for different presentations of ADHD. There's also social constructs associated with that too. A quiet little girl at the back of the class who seems to get it but can't put it down on paper. And have we looked at ADHD? Yeah, but she's not climbing trees and breaking arms and things like that. But there's social constructs behind that I think are at play as well as the different processes that our brains develop. Different brains develop, different genders, their brains develop at different rates and in different ways. I can't comment on others and the process of prescribing. What I can do, though, is to say that I've seen some real success in the use of sustained release psychostimulant treatment. So far less able to be misused. Yeah. And I go back to people don't choose, they don't look forward in their lives as a child to being unemployed and a drug addict with real difficulties negotiating their environment. So to find something that works just as well but doesn't cause the risk of criminal activity or the risk of brain damage is fantastic. So I do see there's merit in these medications, there's merit in the diagnosis, but you've got to go back to a really good quality longitudinal assessment and engagement, and that's why primary health is so important. The process, because of the scheduling of psychostimulants, the scheduling of drugs is considered the nature of the risks of each medication and where that sits. So opiates have always sat in a Schedule 8, which is a really quite a restricted schedule. Psychostimulants sit within that same schedule. So, and a couple of the stronger fluorinated benzodiazepines like prazolam, which is known as Xanax, or flunitrazepam, known as Rohypnol, they're in the Schedule 8 for very clear reasons of risks associated with that. And with that then comes specialist oversight. That's sought. It's needed. We're looking at the research that's going into psilocybin and MDMA. Now, that's some pretty cutting-edge stuff, you know what I mean? But at the same time, it's being delivered through really good quality specialist oversight. The concern, though, going back to ADHD and the requirement for a psychiatrist, a specialist to provide authority to a GP to continue to prescribe that medicine, is getting in front of the psychiatrist.
Right.
And then what happens as a result of that? You get your diagnosis, you go back to your GP, but is your GP able, because a GP is a specialist in their own right too. There are some GPs that specialise in women's health, in children's health, in diabetes, in mental health, in addiction. So, you know, it's getting the right team behind you to manage that, because with the best intentions, iatrogenic outcomes occur, which is where you try to do good and it ends up going to shit.
Mm. So how do we do better? That's a big question, I know. Yeah.
That's for bigger minds than mine. Yeah. I think if we slowed down and just had a look at the way we deliver care, we've got a really good model of care at First Step, but we run on a shoestring, and we do that because we've got a lot of people who've got a bit of extra cash who say, okay, well, these guys are doing all right, and they're doing stuff that seems to be working better than other approaches. So we do get some philanthropic support. We certainly do get some support through the federal government. But we have a whole of person approach. So ADHD is a great example of, you know, people have co-occurring health conditions. So you could find somebody who would really benefit from psychostimulant treatment, but their cardiac function's not going to let them, because by giving them the psychostimulant treatment, they will have a negative outcome.
A heart attack, right? Health.
So, you know, it's whole of person care, slow down and work together.
Let's talk about these co-occurring issues. The one that I specifically have in mind that I'd like to talk to you, Joe, about is people that come to First Step, or not, but there are people, many, many, many people out there who present with mental illness and then seek to treat that mental illness with alcohol or drugs. Then they become addicted to that substance. And time and time again, what I've heard happen is that the person will present to a rehab, and they'll be considered too mentally unstable to do an inpatient stay. And then they go to the mental institution, but they may have smuggled drugs in because they're an addict. And the mental health system says, no, sorry, you're an addict, you can't stay here. They fall through the cracks, right?
Historically, yeah. And I think even currently, no, that's fair. And keeping in mind too that we've got to work in a safe environment wherever we work, so that people with co-occurring needs and there can be risks associated to that person. You know, we have community detoxes, for example, detox withdrawal units, drug withdrawal units that are aimed to have a 7 to 10 day admission, that they're supported in a community, a residential but a community situation. So people with significant addictions to particular, also dependence to particular substances, alcohol being one, the risks in withdrawal of seizures and other really quite serious physical conditions, you know, that can be too much for a community, a residential detox facility. So we need to look at a medical detox facility. The example I use, I suppose, you know, that's an episode of care. 7 to 10 days is an episode of care, and that is physically that the substance has been withdrawn from the body. The person has gone through a process of a set of withdrawal symptoms that they should resolve after a certain amount of time. And then that's an episode of care, 7 days, maybe 10 days. Some of the substances that we're seeing and working with people to withdraw from last longer. You know, GHB, for example, actually sort of presents in many respects like a quite severe alcohol or benzo withdrawal, but it lasts longer and it's far less predictable. Alcohol's more predictable. If you took two people, similar age, let's say single mums, both drink two bottles of wine a day, both have two kids at school, similar age, one mum comes home and has a glass of wine while she chats to her kids, and the second glass of wine while she helps with homework and afternoon tea. Third glass, and these are big glasses to get through bath and bed, opens the second bottle, makes her own dinner, has the second glass of the second bottle, finishes the dinner, has the third glass, watching disc or, you know, hard chat, and off to bed. Then you've got a person who is drinking as a regular daily consumption, 15 standard drinks a day. So the withdrawal process for that is predictable. If you take another mum who drinks that whole first bottle just to get through school pickup and get their kids home and manage the anxieties associated with that, and they're into the second bottle to manage the bath and bedtime, which is a hard sport, I know from personal experience, that may end with dinner, that may not.
Mm. Seems to me that there's just still such a long way to go with this. You know, I have another, somebody comes to mind who I know who was struggling with what was presenting as BPD and couldn't get into a psychiatric facility because they said that she wasn't well enough. Thinking, well, where do they go?
So there's a school of thought, and this is baby with bathwater stuff, yeah, because the one size fits all has never really worked, but we keep on.
And so there's a school of thought that says that people who have personality vulnerabilities that lead them to real challenges in negotiating their environment and their community, to hospitalise that person is actually detrimental. And you can see validity in that in some respects, because they realise I can go into a bubble and I don't have to deal with stuff. So coming out of the bubble's a lot harder. But it's also taking a step back from the diagnosis and looking at the person. So what has changed in that person's life? And, you know, we closed the old asylum or psychiatric hospitals, and we opened up a different approach to care with case management, clinical case management, with CAT teams, with more community support. But what I think we got was that what those asylums or hospitals provided was certainly solace, but also home for people who were otherwise to be homeless. The grounds were big. Go to a mental health ward, now they are a hospital ward. There's nowhere to really move around. And so we did away with what is in so many ways a draconian approach to care of removing agency and liberty and controlling someone's existence to reduce the risk that their psychiatric condition may pose on the community or to themselves. But I think there's still got to be some wiggle room and some individual considerations, because, you know, yes, people who are identified as having a personality disorder will often seek to gain an admission, and that may be done through maladaptive means, you know, overdoses and deliberate self-harm. It can be considered, oh, well, they've done that so as to get into hospital, and if we acquiesce, then we're going to de-skill this person. But I do think you need to look at the individual processes, because there are always higher risks associated with people who are in high distress.
And then there's also the people that are perhaps in psychosis, then commit a crime and then end up in prison, and that's not really the right place for them to be either. Like, I know we have Thomas Embley, which tries to, you know, treat people that are unwell mentally who have also committed crimes, but from my understanding, it's a very small number of beds in that hospital. And like, what do we do with that population?
You've touched on a bit of a sore point. It's very difficult to really, for at least for me, and those that work in the public health setting, it's difficult to I don't have a grasp on how care is provided in the prison system, because the prison system don't use Medicare. The prison system use their own assessment processes. They certainly provide medications, and you can advocate, but it's a very different system. And I think that's a different podcast for time. That said, the frustration I think I have is that, you know, psychosis is psychosis, you know, so delirium is delirium. Delirium is a medical condition, which is a medical emergency. It needs to be treated, and the person is at risk due to the fact that they have a fluctuating level of consciousness and very, very limited understanding of their environment. Psychosis is psychosis, whether it be if you've got a diagnosis of schizophrenia and for whatever reason, whether it be through grief and loss or stress or trauma or drug use, it an acute exacerbation of that psychosis presents. That's one thing. I think the issue, though, for people who don't have a diagnosis of schizophrenia, we all have a threshold to psychosis, sleep deprivation, pain, grief, depression, mania. All of these things can lead to psychotic phenomena, which is just, it's as simple as a disorder of thought content, of thought form, or of perception. How it came about, it's not really relevant for the immediate risks and the immediate need for treatment for that person. But I do think that the two, we come at them from different angles, and somebody who presents with a drug-induced psychosis is considered in a different way to somebody who has a bona fide diagnosis. I think that may need to change. Going back to your original question is, what do we do? One of the things that I think if I was to retire now, I'd know what to do, but look, by the time I retire, I think I'll look back. There's been huge changes in psychiatric care and addiction care in my time, in my career, huge changes. But probably the most prominent and the most positive is the introduction of peers into the care team, because lived experience is the only way to bridge the gap between us and them. And the more we involve peers and lived experience, the more likely we are to identify the fact that it's not us and them, it's just we. Mm-hmm. But it will also allow a return to the person rather than a set of diagnostic categories, criteria, and ways in which to treat.
Yeah, it's such a powerful point, isn't it? Having, it's the same as if you're, you know, in 12-step fellowship and you're speaking to somebody who's walked the path before you, that lived experience, that sense of identity and being able to see yourself in someone else creates a sense of, like we said earlier, safety, which I think is so important to healing.
We've never been able to replicate the outcomes, and the term novel, I don't mean in a negative sense or condescending way. It is novel in the sense that we can't encapsulate it. And peer-led programs, they succeed for people, not everyone, and certainly not everyone. That's important. Again, one size doesn't fit all. But I think that, you know, the successes of the fellowship are tried and true since the 50s. And you know, initially the aim, Bill's aim, was to get as much money in and to build something. And actually he thought better of it. And those that were advising and supporting his process thought better of it and said, you know, no. You're the thing. You know, these people are the thing. Doesn't matter what roof's over your head. Don't need buildings. You don't need, you know, it's not, you know, PricewaterhouseCoopers style. You know, you just need a roof over your head, but you're, and that's the novelty. Doesn't matter where you are accepted in the same way, the novelty of that, the novel successes, the unquantifiable or not indescribable, are certainly describable, and they play out in the successes. Hundreds of thousands of successes over the years, but the fact that it can't be medicalized, I think, pisses some minds off, and it's disregarded. But we can't do it that well. And what we can do is learn from it, and say, well, one of the key components, as you say, is who's walked this path, and bring them in. And these people should be celebrated. These should be considered in the same way as any other clinical intervention. They need to be celebrated, and it lends itself to human rights and liberty. Who are you to tell me? It's like, I'm not, man, but I've got a guy here who really knows what you're going through. You know, I've got some skills in a particular area, and so does this person, and we're going to get together as a whole. We're going to work together, and we're going to walk together, and we'll come to the other side.
Yeah, it's like you said, tried and tested, something's working. Joe, there's one last topic that I really want to touch on today, and that is the impact that mental illness and addiction can have on the family. We had a little chat about this, you know, on the phone the other day, and you know, we're sort of just coming into the new year at the moment, and Christmas is always a really challenging time. But what are you seeing at the moment?
Yeah, look, it is in so many ways. You know, illnesses of any sort, medical or psychiatric or you know, addiction, can it requires a change in role within the family, changing roles. You can have an intimate partner that develops a very significant illness, and that role redefinition into care provider is quite challenging for parents who have their minds a view of where they want to see their children. Certainly don't have children and go, well, I really hope they get addicted to meth. So I think, yeah, I think the role redefinition is challenging, and it's more or less for different people. The challenges with families that I see is finding help and support. It's great to have support organizations to support families, but what they actually need is throughput. They need help navigating a system that's convoluted, bureaucratic, and challenging to even get in the door. I think as a whole, so a whole system, I think we are getting better at understanding that and helping people getting to a point of a no wrong door policy. But even once you get through the door, we're still seeing that that's not my area, man. So look, there's a guy over in Fitzroy. So I think we, again, if you're looking at the whole of person, yeah, an old palliative care nurse said to me long, long, long time ago when I was in my undergraduate training, in describing what defines a person, the person in the bed, it could be one way to look at it. but it's actually the feet around the bed that can actually describe that person. And in a palliative care setting, you can see that, and that describes a life in so many ways, the presence or absence. And I think that we forget that. Mental health acts, if you're looking at, you know, enforced treatment, mental health acts have tried as best as they can, as they develop, to involve families within reason, but there's still privacy, there's still those sorts of issues. And again, it comes the same way with addiction. It's really hard. Families want to get support for their people. They get the person through the door, but sometimes it's more complex and they don't know what's happening next. So it's a really, really tough gig.
No, I was just going to say, so important for the family members affected to also seek not just support, but in many ways their own treatment.
Yeah.
Therapy.
Yeah, that's right.
Getting the answers and being guided by something that would otherwise perhaps feel completely overwhelming and so, so challenging to navigate.
Look, I've got a couple of situations where we've supported in, for example, the Health Justice Partnership, where a care provider, a parent or in one case an adult child, had incurred significant fines as a result of their car being used by a person who was in active addiction or who was psychiatrically unwell. And again, that needs to be considered in its context rather than the person's just lived their life disregarding the tolls, for example. You know, it can be as complex and challenging being a care provider as it can being the person that's unwell. But yeah, look, the systems are forever changing to try to understand. And I go back to the fact that if you've got somebody sitting there that may not have the academic underpinning, which is good because they think from a different angle and they go, oh, hang on, man, this is same stuff. We see this all the time. You know what I mean? So, you know, some of the medicines that we see diverted onto the street and used, if you go into the hospitals and you ask one of the ED doctors, well, what would you say if you took, a medical doctor, what would you say if you took 5 grams of Lyrica? Oh, well, you'd be dead. It's like, well, I've actually seen a guy who takes that about every day, you know. So the understanding doesn't disseminate back through. And again, got peers involved and accepted for that very special set of skills, then I think we can go a little bit further to designing care and providing it.
It's this whole idea, isn't it, of shine a light on it, don't shy away from it. You know, I think the same thing goes for safe injecting rooms. Limiting these places and say, no, I don't want another one coming up in that suburb. You know, the drug addicts are going to hang around there. Like, it's just such a warped way of thinking, like, this is a place that saves lives, not a place that brings people together to use heroin. It's quite the opposite. Yet there's this fear, the media plays into it. And every time we stigmatize it, every time we throw shade, you know, the situation, the problem just gets worse.
Yeah. But to disregard, I think it's tough too, because again, the individual experience, you know, of a person who's had an interaction as a result of someone's addiction that's led to their harm to them, theft of their car, their house broken into. Consideration for that's one side of things. You know, the idea of safe injecting rooms is significant. We that I understand, we don't have needle exchange programs in prison. So, you know, that'd be a step in the right direction, because the cost of treating Hep C, which has been so successful, it's huge. And the reason that the TGA approved it and put it onto the PBS so it doesn't cost literally tens of thousands of dollars to treat Hep C now, is because Hep C was a significant health burden. So they could see, well, let's pay for this now and let's eradicate Hep C. But if you don't put safe injecting, if you don't put needle exchange programs in, then the risks of reinfection and transmission is still there.
Yeah.
Kind of doesn't make sense.
Yeah. We need this broad spectrum approach rather than, I think, just putting out spot fires here, there and everywhere.
Yeah.
Joe, we're coming to the end of our conversation today. I've really, really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you so much. I want to know, what do you actually do for your own mental health? You're at the front line every single day working with people who are sometimes incredibly disturbed. What do you actually do to look after yourself?
So, yeah, recently I've returned to playing cricket, old man cricket. Awesome. But this season, unfortunately, I wasn't able to. I had to have a procedure. So I'm hoping to return at the end of the season for a game, a cameo appearance. I have varying hobbies. I have turtles. I have a dachshund that is my angel. I think taking a step back and being grateful for what I've got, I think is really important. But also reflecting on the work that we do with others who do our work, is so important because it can reinforce, but reflecting on what you do so you do it better as well is important. And if I get to a point where it does impact me, I think I'll probably look to change. Yeah, I think just looking after myself physically, I had a previous colleague who I just adore and hold in such high regard who finds solace in exceptionally long distance running, and I think that is insanity.
He's a friend of the show.
He sure is, yeah. But that's his thing, you know, that's where he finds it. I play guitar, I like the downtime, I like to sit. You know, we wouldn't have been given asses if we weren't meant to sit down. So I can sit and play guitar and watch my turtles and think of Ben running.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, Joe, thank you so much for today. We say here on Behind the Smile that when we recover loudly, no one needs suffer in silence. So thank you so much for everything you do and for being here today.
Ash, thanks for having me.
A big thank you for tuning in today. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by hitting the follow button and leaving a rating and review. Each rating and review helps this podcast become more discoverable so more people can hear these stories of strength and hope. Together, we will continue to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. Remember to reach out to those you care about, and I'll be back next week. Until then.